Excellent.
You're very welcome as well. And how many people are sort of in between looking for jobs, or even student and looking for a job? Or working and looking for a job too? Okay, good. All right. So the topic is right livelihood. And it's a good topic to talk about because when I first came across it, the explanation that I read was fairly basic, to be honest, right? But then when I started reading more about it, look what I came up with, a whole diagram. And I realised that right livelihood really is an important factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, and I'll go and talk about that later as well. So it's a path that the Buddha set out for our practice, and one of them, out of the eight, is right livelihood. So it must be pretty important. And often right livelihood is described as choosing a job, an occupation that is helpful to our practice, okay? That doesn't harm others and that supports us and it's good to us, okay? In a very simplistic kind of way. And if you think about how many hours we spend at work, and even as students, how many hours that you spend studying, it really consumes a lot of our life. And so it's important that we do direct our life in a positive way. And so choosing the right livelihood and how we want to direct our life in that is an important factor of the path. So when I talk about the path, I'm talking about our Dharma path, our spiritual path, our path of our way of life. Now, I'm not very good at drawing pictures, so I'm going to use symbols instead, so bear with me. Now, your life is not going to look like this. It will probably look more like this in terms of a path. But this is your Dharma path, okay? This is your life's path. And we start over here with the worldly life. Sometimes you read in the suttas, in the scriptures, mundane is the word. And on this end, we've got our spiritual life. And you're reading the sutras, super mundane. Okay. Can the people at the back read my handwriting? Good. Okay. So we start off here, and we've got money. The worldly concerns about money. I don't know how to draw peace, so I'm just going to do this. Right. So that's the spiritual, okay? I was going to draw someone meditating, but I'm just not good enough for that. And in terms of our own Dharma practice, how we often enter the door of the Dharma, okay? So that's, again, a term from the Buddhist scriptures. There are different ways in which we come in contact with the Dharma. We walk through the door of the Dharma. So you may have encountered Buddhism through family, okay? So like myself, I was brought up in a Buddhist family. But part of my upbringing as a Buddhist was really going to temples and, you know, praying that I would get straight A's, and all of that. So it really wasn't in terms of the Dharma, but it was sowing a seed in me. How I really came in contact with the Dharma was through reading. So you may have come through the door through reading, through talks, through friends, through uni buds, okay? Various Buddhist centres and organisations. So on your path, you start to get in contact with the Dharma. Then, you start reading more about the Dharma, you start to think, well, you question whether the worldly life, the way of the world, is really going to lead to happiness. You start to question whether the happiness that you get from your worldly life, really, is it substantial? Okay? So you may or may not be here yet. And what you start to question
Sorry.
There's a disillusionment. And what that means is you start to think, well, yes, I may have the career that I want. I may have gotten into the university that I wanted to, or I may have gotten into the course that I wanted to, but are you happy? And how I first came in contact with that in this context was I was striving to get into university, right? And then I got here. And I was like, okay, I'm happy for like a week. And then the assignment starts and all of that. And then it's like, oh, so much suffering. Then I thought, okay, well, maybe if I get into law, maybe then I'll really enjoy it. Okay, so delusional. So when I get into law, I'm happy for about a month. And then the assignments is like double what I had before in my first degree. Okay, so even more suffering. And then I thought, okay, maybe it's just because I'm a student. I don't have weekends, so maybe when I start working, I'll enjoy it more, right? Because once I start working, I get weekends. Does this sound familiar? And then I start working. And then what happens? Oh, student life was so much better. No responsibility. You know, you fail and you just do it again, right? Unlike in a job, where if you fail, there are real dire consequences, okay? So the stress is different. So constantly we're looking into the future about something. And then once we get something, it doesn't live up to our expectations. Right? So that's what I'm talking about in terms of that disillusionment. And what you're starting to explore is a really important component of Buddhism, and it's dissatisfaction. The Pali word, so the ancient Indian word, is dukkha. Part of our practice is to really look suffering in the face, really understand it, not pushing it away. Your classmates, society generally, doesn't want to look at dukkha. They don't want to see the ugly side of life. They just want to cover it up and constantly put band-aids and band-aids on our wounds and constantly trying to get that instant gratification. If you're unhappy, quick fix, right? Quick fixes, quick fixes. But what our practice is about is not just having those quick fixes, but allowing the wounds to be there and seeing it and understanding it. So at this point in time, you explore dukkha, right? Dissatisfaction. And I put a sad face just because I don't know how else to draw dukkha, right? But dukkha isn't negative in that sense. It's just as it is. It's a dissatisfaction with your life. And why this stage is really important is because often this is where insight arises. Have you noticed in your life where you've improved the most, where you've actually changed yourself the most, is when you've gone through some sort of suffering, some sort of problem, and you've overcome it? Often in the problem, you're struggling and you don't want it, right? You really don't like it. You just think, oh, I hope this never happened to me. But once you overcome your problem, whatever it may be, and you learn from it, and you're a better person because of it, and you can actually find some gratitude for the experience. I am very fortunate that I had the suffering that I had in the past because I learned from it. So I know how to deal with it next time. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. But the fact that I experienced it made me a better person because it helped my Dharma practice. So that's the next part of the path. Then, when you start to find that dissatisfaction, and then through your understanding of the Dharma and your practice, you start to find some value in the Dharma practice. Because you find that the more you practice, the more you get this. So you turn from that to this. So you get a lot more joy. So this is where people like to do good merits, for example. So merit making. Because they find in giving, they themselves are happy. right? And the way of the world is often that you accumulate, you get things, you keep things. And it's quite a self-centred culture. We want, we constantly want. But ironically, it's actually when we start to simplify our life, when we start to let go of things and not be so attached to things, that's actually when the real happiness comes. Right. So, the next part of the path, this is where I'm really getting into my talk, is where we start to find that we want to use our Dharma practice to enrich our life. So this is the path so far, okay? I hope that we're all up to here, okay? Because you're all sitting here. So that at least suggests to me that you find there is some value in the Dharma practice. You find that it has been helpful. And so what you want to do is you want to incorporate as much of that into your daily life as possible, yes? And so in our jobs, because we spend so much time in it, we want to be able to bring our Dharma practice into our day-to-day life through our work. And the way we do that is actually through two streams. One is our career choice. That's fairly obvious. Okay. So when it comes to career choices, I'm not going to sit here and judge various careers, so I'm not going to tell you whether or not to be an architect or not. or as an example, so why I give that example is just because some people during my talks they would say to me, "Oh, Rob, in this particular industry, what do you think about that?" And I can't answer it because I'm not there, okay? Because I don't do that job. From an outsider's perspective, I can give some comments, but it won't be helpful at all. But rather, it's about you reflecting on the career choices that you make. So for those who are students, or even those who have already started working, if you have the energy and the resource to change your career direction in a positive way, do it, okay, if you feel you need to. But that is an individual personal choice, and no one external can really guide you in that. The Buddha himself did not sit down and write out a whole list of all the things that people shouldn't do, but he did name five particular trades that he said are not conducive to spiritual practice. So those five trades are, first of all, not to trade in arms or weapons. Okay, so in our modern age, that would suggest anything to do with the to do with military, okay, with arms, with weapons. The second is in relation to not to trade in humans, so slavery. Now, we don't really have that, but there are different deviations of slavery. The third is not to trade in flesh, so that's to deal with animals, not to literally talk about flesh. So animals. Now, that is definitely something that's still a live occupation in our society today. So butchers, for example, factory farming, that's still something that exists now. The fourth is not to engage in trade of intoxicants, right? So drugs, alcohols, no good, don't go there. And that's because if we ourselves want to uphold our precepts, our principles of doing good, one of the precepts is not to engage, not to take illicit substances or intoxicants, because it clouds the mind and it makes us break the other precepts. So likewise, if we ourselves wouldn't do it, why encourage others to do so? Okay? And the fifth one is not to trade in poisons. Fairly obvious. In our day and age, it gets a bit grey as to what poisons are and as to what's harmful, right? So are you starting to see how it's not that straightforward? Particularly now, our occupations are a lot more complex than how it was in the Buddhist society. Now, we may be doing something here, but that would have ramifications over here that we may not know about. As an example, this is often raised. Someone is working in a restaurant and they sell intoxicants because most restaurants do, right? Is that right livelihood? Don't know. Right? So we get into some really grey areas. Then, to make things even more grey, when I was doing my research, I came across some suttas that says the Buddha actually warned against someone who was in the army, who was a soldier, right? And here's another one. There's a whole sutta on this person who's actually an actor. He goes to Buddha and says, oh, this is what I do as an occupation. I'm an entertainer. And the Buddha said, okay. Didn't want to answer him. And the person pressed the Buddha three times and says, what do you think about it, essentially? And the Buddha says, well, because you've asked me so many times, I will tell you. And in essence, he says it's not a good occupation because what you're doing is you're actually stirring up other people's emotions. You're stirring up other people's greed, anger, and delusion because you're creating this whole fiction. You're drawing them into your story, right? And, of course, I read this right after Body Night, so I thought a bit bad. but no. If you do it as a occupation, as a long-term thing, whatever your occupation is, whatever your current occupation is or whatever your future occupation is, these are things you need to think about. Because that got me thinking too. I mean, you wouldn't expect to be an actor to be on one of the lists that the Buddha would say, actually, it's not a good occupation, right? But he's got a good reason for it. And I think if we start to look into what our spiritual practice is about, and if we want to do good for other people, which means encouraging them with their own spiritual practice and not doing harm to others, we need to start thinking about those grey areas in between. And this is why it's hard to just put your foot down and say, well, don't do this kind of stuff, right? Because often people, if you do that, they will say, well, no, I've got a good reason for why I'm doing it. And then there will be some arguments. That's not the point. For you personally, you looking at what you do, is it a healthy occupation? Is it an occupation that's good for you and good for others? Is it an occupation that does not harm others and that does not harm yourself? That's the test. Okay? I'll pause there before I go on to my second point for any questions. Very good? No questions? Okay. The second point that I want to raise about this is a career choice. This is like your overarching thing. And for those people sitting in the audience saying, well, that's all good, but I can't get out of the job I'm in, or I've already invested so much time into what I'm studying, I can't change it. Or the other option is, well, my job is pretty neutral. I just look at figures all day. It doesn't really impact on others, right? Fair enough. But there is still a way to bring the Dharma practice into your life. There's no other than the Noble Eightfold Path, because that is the path set by the Buddha. And in my talks, I often talk about the Noble Eightfold Path, and I keep stressing it, because it is important. But tonight, I'm going to put a different spin on the Noble Eightfold Path. I'm going to talk about it in the context of our right livelihood, our career, our work. How do we actually utilise the Noble Eightfold Path in our work? Here, I won't write down, but let's just go through them. The first factor is right view. Right view or right understanding is about having the right perspective in what we're doing and right understanding of the reality of the life that we're living. So, one perspective is we should understand the law of karma very well. And it's not understanding by belief. So it's not just because I'm sitting here telling you you should understand karma. But it's about you looking into your life and seeing how karma actually operates in your life and making it real for you. Is karma something that you see? Do you see the consequences of the actions that you make? No? So that's right view. And when you approach your day-to-day life in work in the same way, you see the way that karma actually operates. So that's one thing. The second thing is an understanding of what's called the three marks of existence. So the first is understanding impermanence, anicca. You know, our life is constantly changing, continuously. We're like on a stream and it just keeps flowing. And likewise, in your job, it's not the same every single day. Even if you feel that you have such a boring, mundane job and everything is always the same, it's actually not. There will always be factors that change. And with impermanence, it's also important to remember some other things are impermanent too. And I'm going to introduce something to you if you haven't heard it already, which is the eight worldly winds. There are eight things in this lay life, in this worldly life, that come and go. And these eight things are praise and blame. You may be praised today by your employer, by your boss, by your teacher, by your lecturer. And you feel good about it. And it's easy to actually attach to that and want more of it. But what happens if blame then arrives? How do you feel? How do you deal with that? You push it away, aversion. So you're constantly grasping for praise and pushing away blame. But the eight worldly winds, they just keep coming and going. They just flow. The other two is loss and gain. We're always getting stuff, but we're always losing stuff, constantly. No life is always about getting, 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 getting. And no life is always about losing, losing, losing also. It's a matter of perspective sometimes. Sometimes people think that they're always losing. That's not quite true. You miss the times when you've got something. But the point is, all of these things are just winds. They just flow. They just come. They go continuously. So we've got praise, blame, gain and loss. The next couple is status and disgrace. Because each of us, if we attach to what's our reputation, what people think of us, and we make that as part of our identity, then that's when we've lost. Because we've attached to status and we've attached to disgrace. And the next two is about pleasure and pain. So sitting there, you may feel pain because you've sat there for so long and you move. Or at certain times you may feel pleasure. But notice that these things just come and go continuously. Nothing is permanent. Right. So the right view and the right approach when it comes to looking at our career and at our jobs is to keep in mind the eight worldly winds. How do they come? How do they affect you? And how is it that we should maintain ourselves when they do come? And the key here is about equanimity. It's about having a balanced mind. A mind that is unmoved by the eight worldly winds. So when someone comes and praises you, how do you accept it? How do you accept the praise? Do you say thank you and let it go? Do you push it away and say, oh, no, I'm way too humble to accept that, right? Do you attach to it and want more of it? Same thing with the others. When praise comes, when gain comes, when loss comes, do we get moved? Or do we maintain our equanimity? Right? So that's the first one with impermanence, anicca. The second one is anatta. It's about non-self. It's about being less attached to our ego, less self-centered in our work, in our approach. Because, as you know, if people work in a team at work, it's way better than when you have one person who just wants everything, yes? When someone is just being selfish and wants everything. So if you work, just try to identify that. Try to identify the times when you are attached to yourself, when there are times when you feel that it's yourself versus the others. Or are you actually working in collaboration with them? And the third aspect is about dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. So in your work, when you start feeling that you get really attached to it, start to see, what are you actually attached to? What is it about it that is significant for you? Okay? So that's right view. The next part of the factor is right intention. Now, this is really important because it's with your intention that you sow the seeds for what will then come. It's actually the commencement of how the karma works. So what is your intention? What is your intention, firstly, in the holistic thing? So what is your intention of your job, of your work? Is it the right intention? And then you bring that down a level, on a more microscopic level, on day-to-day interaction level. When you talk to someone, when you sell someone something, when you deliver something, when you create a project, whatever you do, what is your intention? Is it a wholesome intention? So constantly checking back into yourself. One aspect of intention is if we're not careful and if we're not mindful, what will underlie our intention are three things. One is greed. So, if you're in business and you make a lot of money, you need to check your intention. Is there greed there? The next is ill will. Check your intention for ill will. If you're dealing with a really frustrating customer, right, and you're talking back to them, check your intention. Is your intention one of ill will and aversion, wanting to get rid of them? The third is about delusion. This is a lot harder to see as an intention, actually, but it's there. When you're not quite clear, when you're not quite sure, and you still act, despite not knowing clearly what's going on, not knowing whether it's wholesome or not, but you're just going to act. So just be really sure with your intention. And another thing with intention is, as I said before, is it about a self-promotion? Is it about getting something for yourself? Or is it about sharing it yourself with others? Being able to be accommodating with others, working with others? Is it to create goodwill with others? Or is it about yourself? And you know, this is really hard because you have to be honest. And no one is going to be standing over you. Sometimes you may get away with stuff. People can't look into your heads. So on the outside, you may seem to be doing the right thing, but you know deep down that your intention is not quite right. So no one actually knows, but you know. And so the only person who can check is yourself. But regardless of whether or not other people know, you have created a seed, and the seed will somehow bloom. And if the right seed is put in and it's a wholesome intention, it will bloom in good ways. But if it's not, then you have to be careful. And you need to see that in your own life. So don't believe it, but see it. See what happens. If you do the same action, but with the right intention, what's the consequence? And one good example is when you start talking to people, right? So in the job I do a lot of talking. And I think in most professions now, especially if you do customer service, you do a lot of talking. What is your intention when you talk to someone? See if you can approach each person like they're a new person that you're talking to. And check your intention every single time. Is my intention still to help this person and resolve their issues or their questions? Or is my intention, I just want to do my job and get out of here? Whatever the intention is. So check your intention. Right, so the third aspect is right speech. Now, when it comes to right speech, there's different components. One is about no false speech, so no lying. Being really honest and truthful. And the way to do that is to value truthfulness. Because if you value truthfulness, it actually makes it harder for you to tell a lie. If you value other people being honest with you, then it makes it easier for you to be honest with others because you want them to deal with you in the same way. So truthfulness. The next is about no idle chatter, right? This is hard in an office when most people actually engage in idle chatter. I mean, how many conversations are there about the weather? You know, and I have to admit, I do it too, because you're looking for a topic and there's nothing to talk about, and you look at the sky and you just go, oh yeah, it's a beautiful day, isn't it? It's fairly obvious, okay? So idle chatter. But then in your dealings with others, notice that if you actually have a conversation with them that is meaningful to you and that's meaningful to the other person, what happens to your working relationship with them? It gets much better. Whereas if you're constantly having really superficial conversations with others in your work, with your colleagues, with the people that you work with, the clients, you develop a superficial relationship. Right? Now, I'm not telling you to go into your work and start bearing your whole soul and crying to them about everything, okay? Because that would just be unprofessional. So if I rocked up to court and told my clients, like, oh, I had a terrible weekend, what's your problem? You know, that's completely inappropriate. But I could still have a genuine conversation with my clients where I try to empathise with them and really understand them. Okay? Now, another aspect of right speech is no harsh words, no harsh speech. So swearing, you know, and sometimes it's not the words, it's actually your tone, the manner in which you come across. Now, I'm sure you've dealt with hostile people before in the past, and you probably didn't like it, and you probably wouldn't want to work with someone like that. So likewise, if we adopt that same kind of manner with others, surely they will feel the same way, and they wouldn't want to work with you too. So right speech is really important. And especially in an office environment, you would get this, which is gossip, right? Talking badly of other people, putting other people down so you look a bit better. Or, you know, some people just like gossip. It's like, oh, do you know so-and-so did this and this and that? Okay. What? And again, check back into your intention. Why are you saying these things? And what would be the consequences? What kind of friction will you create between other people if you say these things? And in the office, office politics is a big problem. Bullying is a big problem. And when I talk about office politics, forget even office politics. You get two people in a room and there would be politics, right? Because if people don't understand, they struggle for power. That's what happens. So how do you deal with that? And if you haven't come across it already, you're very likely to. So how do you maintain your own values? So if your practice of right speech is strong in your daily life, try and incorporate that and bring it into your work as well. And you might find initially that it would be difficult, and you may also find that people would react against it. People may test you. People may not believe you. They don't believe that you're that good, that you're that nice. They don't believe you that you would just say good of everyone and you won't engage in gossip. But over time, if you can maintain your integrity with your speech, then it's you. You don't have to prove anything. So right speech. Are there any questions before I move on? Yes.
How do I deal with office politics?
Yeah, good question. You have to be a bit more specific. And you can talk about your friend if you want.
People start gossiping.
People start gossiping. Yeah.
I mean, but usually I just remain passive, but just listen rather than talk.
Yeah. That's a good way, not to engage in it. Yeah. And if it's appropriate, you can actually say something nice about the person.
Okay.
Hmm. People slowly turn, you know, in a different way. They get to know you. And I've actually experienced that. Because lawyers love to talk about gossip about other lawyers, right? But the funny thing is, right, if you start to show yourself in a particular way, people respect that. The stuff that we're talking about in terms of the ethics, the morality, it's actually universal. People don't have to be Buddhists to note that. All humanity would value truthfulness. All humanity would value loyalty. So if you don't go around backstabbing other people and talking badly behind their back and gossiping, that's a good thing. And people would identify that. They may not come up to you and pat you on the back, right? Because they themselves feel that they can't do it. But I mean, they will. It is something of value, and it's your integrity. Office politics is a big one, so I'm going to pause there if anyone has any other questions for their friends.
I'm just wondering, like, sometimes swearing become like common language, common vocabulary.
Yeah.
So if the time is not there, does it still consider swearing?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I first started as a young lawyer, I was taught that if I was going to do criminal law, I have to talk the language of criminals. Right? So I had to go around swearing, right? Because that was their language and that's what I needed to do. And if I didn't, I wasn't clicking with them. I wasn't gelling with them. And can you just imagine a young Asian woman or girl swearing? It just felt so unnatural, you know? And so I'll be around all these lawyers and they're swearing and all that. And it just didn't feel natural at all. And what I found, now I don't swear to my clients. I don't even swear during my conversations with them because I don't need to. And I feel that they actually respect me more. They can swear all they like. I wouldn't blink an eyelid, right? That wouldn't be disrespectful to me, but it's just part of their vocabulary. But I wouldn't engage in that. And that's fine. And same with other lawyers as well. The lawyers I'm talking about are those who've actually known me for a period of time. They've actually changed even their attitude towards me. So they would minimise their swearing around me because I don't do it. And people mirror each other, if you've noticed. So if you're sitting across from someone and they're doing something, you very naturally do the same thing. So if I'm not swearing, they don't feel a need to swear. But if we're both swearing, then everyone just starts mouthing off. Yeah. Another thing is drinking while we're there. I'm jumping ahead a bit. Social drinking, that's a big thing. People often ask me questions. Five precepts, one of them, don't drink. What? Not drink, we're in Australia. Everyone has, like, you know, a stubbies in their hand, right? It's part of the social culture. And some people say they actually feel bullied into drinking. So they're at a social function, everyone's drinking, and they feel obliged to drink. And if they don't, they're sort of outcasted. Again, it's the same thing. You start off and you're actually going against the grain. You're going against what society knows. So there will be some initial reaction. But over time, people know that is you. And if they can respect you for all the other values that you have, that's another thing that they can respect. That's my take. And so far, it's worked for me. I have never, ever felt a need to drink or anything like that around people. And if they don't like it, tough. And some people try using different excuses like, oh, no, I'm the designated driver. Oh, no, I don't drink. Oh, I don't like the taste of it. I just say to them, I don't drink. I don't like how it affects my mind. And it's like, whoa. And then I get into another conversation with them, right? So sometimes it's also about putting your foot down about these things. These things are important to me. These things are a part of who I am. And if you're going to accept me, you accept me for these things. So it's being strong in that way. Okay. Other questions? This is a lot more fun than me just talking about stuff. Okay. And you don't have to talk about work. You can even talk about student life as well. Okay. If you've got questions, keep asking. All right, but I'll move on. Yeah, so office politics. The next is right action. Right, so we've talked about right speech, right action. Touches on the same kind of principles, right? Don't do harm to others, don't do harm to yourself. Try and cultivate good. But more specifically, I want to talk about the precepts. So there's five training precepts that the Buddha suggested that we follow. And those training precepts are there because it's to help us, to guide us. It's not to condemn those people who do it. Right? There's no one upstairs going like, oh, you know, you told a lie. Mark that down. It's not about that. But again, watch what happens if you do break the precepts. What happens to your mind? What happens as a consequence? So the five of them, very quickly. First one, no killing, right? But it's also to cultivate harmlessness. You know, I read this biography from a monk, and he was talking about what the monk life is like. And he says, as a monk, he can give a gift to the world of harmlessness. I thought that was so beautiful. Can you imagine? What you could offer to the world is a gift of harmlessness. Knowing that other people do not need to be afraid of you. And he was talking about how even animals can feel that. Because he has no intention to harm others. So no killing, no harming others. The second one is about no stealing. Ah, in the office, this is fun. So you're not going to go and kill your boss, right? So the first one, we get it. Second one, no stealing in the office. This is going to get a bit controversial. No stealing photocopies, paper, stationery, right? That's a bit hard, isn't it? No. Right, think about it from the employer's perspective. Maybe that would help. But another one that is controversial, no stealing time. Okay? You're being paid for a certain amount of time that you're there, and if you're slacking off, you're actually stealing time. The other one is taxes. I'm getting really controversial. Okay, no dodgy stuff. It's illegal, but also a monk actually said once, when you commit tax fraud, you're not stealing from one person, you're actually stealing from a whole country. Right? So think about the karma involved in that. Goodness. All right. So applying no stealing, not to take what is not given in your own practice, in your own workplace. And you may say, oh, that's going a bit too far, but okay, that's all right. But at least don't steal office furniture, okay? Like, don't steal really obvious kind of stuff. Start there and then keep working down, because you will start to see that even stealing little minor things, that actually affects you. The third one, no sexual misconduct, okay? In your workplace, right, the closest thing I can think of is sexual harassment, which is a real problem. I won't explain too much in here, but as you can imagine, it does happen, and it's not cool, not a good thing to do. The next one is no harsh speech, so we've covered that, right? So right speech. And the fifth one is no intoxicants, so I've touched on that as well. It will be hard sometimes when people around you are drinking and you feel obliged to do so. And I hope that you can hold your ground. But if you can't, okay, know why you can't and think about it next time. Okay, so right action. The next one is right livelihood, which is specifically what we're talking about. The reason why it's placed there is because it actually forms like three pillars. So you've got right, and they all form part of the morality aspect of the path. So you've got right action, right speech, and right livelihood. Three of those pillars, and they have to work together. See how when I talked about right livelihood, I automatically talked about right action, and when I talked about right action, I automatically talked about right speech, because they all work together, because they all form part of the morality foundation for you. Next is right effort. This one is important because sometimes we think right effort is just about being really gung-ho and going at it, working and working and working. Actually, right effort is to not take effort to the extremes. So, you know, definitely laziness would be one extreme, because if you look behind laziness, what is underneath that is sloth and torpor, right? It's just this, I don't want to go, I don't want to do, procrastination, and we know the consequences of procrastination, right? So we've got laziness on one hand as one extreme. Then on the other extreme, we've got those who are just always working, overstressed, overtired. And if you are always overstressed and overtired, first of all, where is your time to practice the Dharma? Where is your time to actually sit and do a meditation session? Where is your time out to go on holidays and go on retreat? And if you're overstressed and overtired, how is your mind? How is your dealings with others? Do you find that whenever you're stressed out, the way you talk to others is a lot more blunt, and it's easier to get frustrated and angry at people? And same when you're tired, when you haven't had your coffee. What happens when you talk to others, when you deal with others? Are you as alert as you should be? So right effort is key. It's not going to the two extremes. Then we've got right mindfulness. Now, when we talk about mindfulness, it's mindfulness of the external environment and the internal environment. So being mindful of your colleagues. It's easy sometimes to neglect the people around you who are working with you. And if you work in offices where you're stuck in the same place with people, believe it or not, you actually see your colleagues more than you see your family members. And that can be quite a scary thought. And then you think about how much effort you put into developing a good relationship with the people who you see more than your family members. Right? So right mindfulness of other people around you, your environment, but also right mindfulness of within what's happening within you. So what is going on inside of you? So when I talked about intention, the ability for you to know your intention before you just automatically act upon them is because you have right mindfulness there. That's your practice. And on a very obvious level, when you're studying and your mind wanders away and you're lost in a fantasy for like a couple of minutes, you know you've done that because of right mindfulness, and you can bring it back. And that leads us to the final factor, which is right concentration. Being able to concentrate, being able to be present, being here, being focused on your job at hand. Surely that must be good for your job. Right? So, that is one path, and I think a very important path, in how we can bring the Dharma practice into our daily lives, into our workplace. So I'll pause there before I move on. Are there any questions?
You mentioned about tax and a thing about tax. I was just sort of curious, what are your thoughts on stories like, say, Robin Hood, for instance?
Robin Hood,
yeah.
Where he steals from the rich and gives to the poor.
Yes, because it's where there's the grey area, sort of.
Yeah.
Because the rich are the ones that are making, that are, you know, putting out the tax.
Yeah.
And.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've got an answer, but what do you think? Not to put you on the spot, but if. Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's a complex. The morality of that story is pretty clear there. And. In that it's the story there is just to provide an insight into power control and features in a society like that.
Mm.
But it's a little bit complex as to, and it's a little bit hard to say in my opinion, in terms of like the current world. And if countries decide to, if a government decides to impose like a high tax on something, but at the same time, you do have, yeah, it's, I honestly do not know.
Yeah. Look, I would agree with you. I think it is a simple tale to convey a simple message. But it actually, if you unravel it, it's actually quite complex as to what the consequences would be. So from the rich people's perspective, hold on, you're taking my money. That's stealing. That's breaking the precepts. That's taking what's not given. And what kind of suffering they would endure, right? But then you look at the poor people and they think, oh, this guy's fantastic. You know, he's really helping us out. So it gets quite tricky. But in real life, if there really was someone who stole, I think he would be breaking the precept and the law, wouldn't you? Yeah. And that is something that we can't deny. And if everyone went, and just imagine, if someone went into the eastern suburbs or into the North Shore because it's known that those people are rich, went into a mansion because it looks rich on the outside, stole a bunch of stuff, and gave it to the people who are living in the refuges, for example. What would you say about that?
But in the end, he sort of had, personally, for that person, he or she would have good intention as well. Or in his or her view, it's the intention to support those who are finding it hard.
Mm. Maybe good intention. I don't know if it's right intention. Sorry.
Yeah. I feel like if you look at Robin Hood, if you think about ethics, like he's, if you apply utilitarianism, then what he's done is right. It benefits more people. But if you look at his action, it's not really right. Stealing is never right. But, so what's your view on ethics and us right living?
Yeah, I'll come back to the ethics question. Just coming back to my question earlier, though. So, you know, you can look at Robin Hood and go, you know, he's fantastic because he lives in, what is it, Sherwood Forest. He doesn't live in Sydney. But if it actually happened in Sydney, you guys weren't so quick to find an answer for it. And that's because who gives this person the right to make that decision and make that choice? And that choice could be wrong. And more importantly, they would have the wrong intention. Because even though you can say, oh, it was a good intention, but it wasn't necessarily the right intention or the right view or the right action even. Okay? And I think there was a comment here at the front first. No? Okay, back.
Can I just make a comment on that about the Robin Hood and the rich?
You've opened a can of worms, you realise.
So just look at it in the context of Robin Hood, okay? The people who are rich were in power, who were greedy, not in a sense like we can come to Sydney and we can't generalise everyone was greedy. And we look at Robin Hood, he was a resistance, a symbol of the, according to the story, just, you know, the poor people who were humble and sweet.
Mm.
So we can't really make a comparison. However, both actions were wrong. So at the end of the day, in terms of Dharma, you know, no one was winning because they were all breaking the precepts.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to add my view.
Sure.
So that Robin Hood thing rests on the assumption that the rich took from the poor in the first place. And so, is that assumption justified or not justified?
Don't know, you have to ask the author. Remember, it's a fiction.
So I think in the medieval context where the feudalism, like, where just class segregation and then the poor live in really poor conditions, you know, the rich looking for their, without the government looking for their interest, then maybe that is a little justified. But, well, when it comes to modern times where, like, so some people are rich because they contribute more to the society.
Some people, they just get it by way of inheritance.
Yes, but then the
it's
rich bestowed right. by to them is the motivation for people to give more product to the society.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe I'll answer it this way, if you don't mind. And this also maybe answers some other questions too. Someone once asked me, do you believe in justice? And I really thought about that. Because as a lawyer, I'm supposed to, you know, be all gung-ho about justice. But I've seen too many cases where there is injustice. And the injustice isn't because of the law. It's just because of the circumstance of things. And what I found was justice and karma are two things. Sometimes someone doesn't get justice, but karma is there in different ways. So when it comes to understanding and unravelling the consequences, the karmic consequences of various actions, I think that my mind is quite limited. And the Buddha himself also said that if you start to unravel every single action and try to figure out the karmic consequences, you will go insane. And that's because unless you really have a clear understanding of past and future of someone and actually see the consequences, that's the only way you can judge. So coming back to my initial answer, which is that's a very simple fairy tale. But when you start unravelling what happens in real life, it's not like the fairy tale, and it actually is a lot more complex.
How about like the conflict of interest in work? Like, if you are a tax consultant, so your duty is like to help the client to minimize the tax, like help the company minimize the tax as much as
legally.
Legally,
yeah.
But sometimes, like, it's legally. Sometimes, but like, you actually like manipulating the way of doing business to
then it's
legally,
not legally
to legally minimize tax, but you do something like register a company in certain tax haven or something, like doing business in a different way, just to like avoid the law.
Are you an accountant? Going to be?
No.
Okay.
I'm more into finance, like.
Yeah, okay.
So it's like, yeah.
Because I was going to suggest we need to ask someone So remember how I said at the beginning, I don't want to start condemning professions because I'll get in trouble. And more importantly, unless we're actually in the job, it's really hard to know. And again, I keep coming back to look within what and see what happens to you when you do it and what manifests. Because that's actually the true test for you as to whether or not you're doing the right thing. And when you start to meditate, you'll start to see that conscience arising. And that's when you'll start feeling a bit more bothered about the things that we do. And that's actually a really good clear indication. Yeah? So I wonder if there's anyone here. Yeah?
I just want to say that people in power, people who hold the real power generally, have a hand in making the laws with regards to tax. But sometimes governments can be corrupt. Why should you pay tax to a government that's corrupt? They misuse the people's money or don't return the money anyway. They get out of the country, which does happen.
Yeah.
So just pursuing a spiritual path in this world is difficult.
Correct, and I'll come to that shortly.
Following this.
Yeah. Yeah, I will come back to that last point. But in terms of the initial point about why should we give money to a corrupt government, I think we all benefit from tax, don't we?
Not if the government is corrupt.
I mean, I get the benefit, I mean, particularly because I'm actually a citizen, I get the benefit of welfare, of a Medicare system that works.
No, I'm talking, we have people from all over the world here.
Yeah.
Not all of it. Australia has a reasonable government.
Oh, I'm just talking from my perspective in terms of what I've got. But I agree with that.
Widening it because your perspective is on shaky ground.
No, I've only got my perspective, so that's okay. But I know what you mean. There are other...
You know, that's why people are raising all these questions.
Yeah.
Because it's not as simple as what...
Yeah. Well, I agree that it's not that simple, and that's why my earlier point was it is complex when you start unravelling it. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Well, can I take your last point? One of the things that people have said about the householder's life is that there is dust in the householder's life. That we live in an imperfect society and we live in an imperfect world. And try as we may in trying to do the right thing, there will be times when there would be negative consequences for what we do. And I'm just putting it out there because it is a reality. Because before, I used to think that the way is actually to use my Dharma practice in my daily life, to enrich my life. But I found that there's actually another step towards the spiritual path. And it's this. It's to use your life to enrich your Dharma practice. Can you imagine? It's not just about fitting Dharma into your life. It's not just about trying to fit 30 minutes into your daily life or meditation. But it's about devoting your life to the practice. It's about devoting your life to a pursuit of truth and happiness. Can you imagine that? Because when I look at this, even when we pursue the Noble Eightfold Path within our Dharma practice, we can enrich our life, we can make it better. We may be better students, we may be better workers, we may even be better people. But ultimately, we are still stuck in this cycle of existence and continuously coming back. And we are still bound by all of the problems that each of you have raised today and all the complexities within it. And this cycle of rebirth, this to-ing and fro-ing, is called samsara. And people describe the samsaric existence as imperfect. And there is no straightforward answers. There's no straightforward answers about tax and Robin Hood. And that is the reason. So I hope part of looking at this is not to say that we all have clear answers, but to recognise that there are limitations to this part. There is a limitation to how, if we use our Dharma practice to enrich our life, it's still trying to fit something greater into something smaller. And what if we had the courage to actually change that around? To actually fit and use our life to enrich our Dharma practice so we can pursue something that's greater than ourselves. And the way we do that, again, comes back to our understanding of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because if you look at this spectrum, over here we start with dukkha, which is also the first noble truth. It's the first truth. It's an understanding of the dissatisfaction in our life. And it's understanding that the reason why there is that dissatisfaction and that unhappiness is because of our craving, our tanha, our constant thirst, our constant want for things. And that's this part. And then we start moving into the Noble Eightfold Path. And there's a particular sutta I would recommend to you all. It's the Mahachaturisaka Sutta. I should write that for. And what this sutta talks about is the Noble Eightfold Path, but in this way, that you can actually follow that path and it would lead you to worldly joy and happiness, which is this first part. But you can also follow that same path, but in a different way, with a different aspiration, and it will take you to the highest aim, which is nibbana. So there's two aspects of it. And when you start practicing each of these, you find that the Noble Eightfold Path is not linear, that goes straight down and you've got the eight. It's actually cyclic because you keep refining it again and again and again as you use each factor. So, looking at this, I hope this sort of directs your life in a particular way when you put your life into perspective. What is your goal? And that goal could be anything. What is it that you want to achieve? And do you want to use the Dharma for that reason? Or rather, would you like to use your life for something that is greater? Now, I was going to end early because I thought I can answer some questions. And I know people have already raised some questions. Are there anything else? Yep.
I think from the previous questions, we know that there's a good wrong action. Is there such a thing as a bad right action?
What's a good wrong action?
So you have a good intentions, but it's a wrong action. So like stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. You have the good intentions, but your actions are wrong.
Okay.
Is there such a thing as a like it's a right action?
Yeah.
Maybe like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like maybe like. Yeah. Killing to prevent more killing.
No, like, it's more like, of like, letting go.
It's like war
for the murderer, and then the murderer kills more people.
Oh, what, sorry?
Like, letting go, like, you catch a murderer.
Yeah.
You know, the right thing to do is to let him go, not to
kill him. Yeah, yeah.
Because you're not allowed to, like, the precepts doesn't allow you to kill.
Right.
Whether if you allow him to go, he would go and kill more people.
Right, okay. That's a good question. Are those the only options, though? either to kill him or let him go?
Depends on the answers. I don't think caging him is an option.
Yeah. See, the problem with hypothetical questions that's been raised, especially tonight, is because it's hypothetical, it's not based in reality. It's you can't answer it. Because whatever answer I'll get, like, challenges, because it's all hypothetical. So,
in relation to him, I actually have I've asked this before a while back, but I'm not sure if it's to you. It's not a hypothetical question, but it relates to medical practice,
right?
Medical research specifically, yeah. Because for the development of medicines, it requires to undergo certain stages,
yeah.
Which involves first animal testing, then human testing.
Okay.
The question there is, you obviously have to, kill animals to find these,
yep.
If they are suitable.
Mm.
So
I know, it's a hard one.
Yeah.
There was a Buddhist who actually was studying psychology, and I remember him telling me that part of what he needed to do as part of his coursework was to dissect rats and also to experiment on them. And he said, looking around, everyone was doing it and it just seemed so normal. But for him, he wasn't comfortable with it. And he didn't pursue that because it wasn't comfortable for him. So for him, he actually found the answer for himself. And I think in terms of that, again, it's one of those grey areas, isn't it? Yeah. And it's whether or not you want to participate in it. Hmm. And there are actually lots and lots of these examples where it does fall in the grey areas when it comes to right livelihood. But the question again, would you want to participate in it and devote your life there in that way? Yes.
What about the situation, do you always have to obey the law? For example, if you live in a country with conscription, the law says if you get called up, you've got to go join the army and go, say, to Vietnam and kill people.
Mm.
But you might not want to go to Vietnam and kill people, in which case you have to refuse to sign up, in which case you'll go to jail. What would a Buddhist do?
Mm. Can I ask the question back? What do you think?
This is a very hard question. Because ethically, you should refuse, but by behaving ethically, you will be punished.
Mm.
And the punishment may be, you may feel that that's unfair. The punishment is so severe that it would disrupt your life. Or, you might be planning to marry or something like that. The punishment would be so severe.
Mm. Yeah, it's actually happened in history many, many times when Buddhists are sent for conscription, and they've actually dealt with it in different ways. And I think the consequences often turn on their karma, because some would decide that they won't go and they will fall into negative consequences, but they bore it and they would prefer that. That's what they say. Some don't go and then they're fine, nothing happens to them. Some go and they, for whatever good fortune they say, they turn out not on the field, so they end up in other areas doing admin and various things like that. So it's quite hard to tell. I mean, it depends on where their life leads, doesn't it? But as to what a Buddhist would do, I don't think there is one straight answer. The Buddha himself did say that to live that kind of life would not be helpful to Buddhist practice. But isn't that obvious? Any other tricky questions? Falling in the hot seat? More more interested about practical questions in your life that you're dealing with, or your friend's dealing with.
Let's say your friend wants you to drink, and when you drink, they're really happy. And you know, your approach is making them happy.
How happy are they when you drink? And after a while, do they really remember how happy you are and how happy they are?
That's true.
And in fact, if you have a car, they may be even more happier if you don't have to drive. If you, they don't have to drive, and you can drive them home.
True. But let's say hypothetically you're in the state or somewhere.
Right.
You don't have to worry about driving, and then they're like, "I'm just drinking."
Okay.
Make you feel like, you know.
Yeah.
That so make them feel bad, like you're not drinking.
Yeah.
Can I share something? Because I've actually had that experience. It was after a military course. And in the military, everyone drinks.
Yeah.
So we all went to, this was in Holsworthy, by the way.
Okay.
We all went to the pub, and you know, we didn't have to worry about driving because we'd get driven there and back.
Yeah.
And so this was 2 years ago at the start of when I was just introduced to Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I decided I wouldn't drink.
Yeah.
So that would be my reason. And the interesting thing is that people actually don't take it, or maybe it's just my personal experience, but I don't take it that, like, it's not a massive shock, and they won't pressure you.
It's good.
Maybe it's my karma. But actually, my corporal, you know, this is someone who's been to Iraq, and he never has less than one girlfriend at the same time.
Right.
Just a typical person you'd expect, you know, out of the military.
Yeah.
And yeah, when I gave the reason, which is, oh, it's because I'm a Buddhist, that was the reason I gave, and he said, okay, so what's Buddhism about?
Cool.
So he's, you know, he's, and he goes to that point and he just turns another way.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're gonna get stuck there.
Yeah. See, that's sort of what I was getting at, you know? It's part of who you are, isn't it? And you put yourself out there. And it takes a lot of guts to do that. It does. But you put yourself out there, that this is me, these are my principles, these are the values, and these are the things that I would stick by. And I would imagine as part of the military, surely that would be a good trait, that you have the strength and you have the integrity to stay with it. So thanks for sharing. Does that help, Francis?
I don't know if I can apply it, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, sometimes you want people to like...
Sorry?
Excuse me? Sometimes you try to fit in as well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course.
It's hard to, like, you know, if you do that, then it's like, oh, what if they don't like
it? Yeah, so that's what I mean, like... It's knowing yourself. It's not being moved. It's being there. It's being genuine to yourself. Because what you are is more than just someone who will drink with them. You're more than a drinking buddy, basically.
Right? How about the guys you plan? You want to get them into business and they want you to drink.
Wouldn't
it's like you have a different intention behind, like,
yeah.
To get them to feel good about you.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing is quite hard.
But wouldn't your client actually prefer someone who was clear thinking as opposed to someone who's totally tipsy?
So to back him up, I would say that I think he's more like a sort of like a gentleman talks behind a, you know, behind, because a lot of the thing when, I'm too young to do business, but a lot of the thing when they say, if you want to do a good business, you need to have a bit of guangxi, a bit of relationship building.
I've heard that too, yeah.
So that's when the drinking comes in. And I think, I mean, if you say I'm a Buddhist, but say if I am, a salsa drinker and I don't feel bad for myself drinking and I actually like the taste of alcohol, assumingly, then I think it's, I mean, it's no harm, I mean, it's not that much harm for me to conduct such an action, isn't it?
It's up to you.
Yeah.
But if you're going to these people, wouldn't you have second thoughts about who you're associating with and how your life will turn up if you're around these people?
Business, not personal life. Yeah.
So you have to choose your the good, the right career.
You can always go for coffee. What, it's sort of like, I'm hearing these things that, like, this is like my opinion, but if you stick to yourself, like what Tina has been saying, I think, like, if everyone makes the benefit for themselves, it, society does change over time. Like, it's like what Ellen was saying before, how, like, he actually said no. I think now there's ads, like, you know, stand up for yourself, say no to peer pressure. Society is slowly changing.
Yeah.
And if we all put in that effort,
then yeah. Yeah, but sometimes it's not only peer pressure, it's like conflict of interest. That's a problem.
How is it a conflict of interest?
Like, when your boss brings you just like to negotiate business, I mean, like, not in Australia, but in China, they, the culture is like when you negotiate business, one, you have to drink. The clients who will like you to drink, and you won't get the business if you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the culture saying, and you can't, and you are the employers of your boss, and you are required.
Yeah.
And you have to act with the, your boss' interests within boss' interests, and this is your duty that you own to them.
Yeah, sometimes we place ourselves in various situations,
yeah.
You know, and sometimes you may feel that you can't change the situation and you're just there, but there is always an ability to change.
Yeah.
If you want it enough. That's the thing, though. If you feel that, no, I could compromise on this, then you would always give yourself an excuse to stay. Yeah. Can you
comment a bit about, just now someone mentioned about drinking socially. And I think a bearable once talked about this topic, and it's more like, someone asked about if I just drink one cup instead of like get drunk like and then do all sorts of things, but if I just drink one cup, is that still breaking the precepts? Or in a way to think about it is, why do you need to drink that one cup? Like, what's your intention of drinking that one cup?
To get acceptance.
Acceptance.
Yeah, because like, I mean, like, yeah, why you want to drink the one cup?
Yeah.
You can ask yourself, sometimes you just want to get acceptance into the group and fit in.
Well, I guess for acceptance, for me, I know that Australian culture is drink a lot. And then on like for my personal experiences, every Friday my team will have a drink on Friday evening. And my manager started with giving me a cup, but I said no. And then the next week, he still gave me a cup, and I still say no. But after a while, he understands that I don't drink, and he respects my choice of not drinking, and he stops giving me that one cup. But sometimes he might replace that with juice or something else. So it's like what Tina mentioned, is to stick to your ground and to stick to what you believe is right.
Yeah.
And back to the question of why do you want to drink a cup? Is it? I think the answer that Berenberg gave was quite true, in the sense that is it your own greed that you want to taste that drink, and that's why you drink it? So I don't have an exact answer, because everyone will have different answer, but it's just up to you to find your own answer.
Can I suggest an alternative solution? If someone passes away a cup of wine or alcohol, just hold it in your hand. pretend that you are actually pretend that you are about to drink, but you actually don't drink it at all. Then you can still clean the group, and so.
Oh, I think they could tell. When they've finished like a whole bottle and you're still holding that one. I don't know if this works, but I have seen in the movies, like, they pretend to drink and they just throw it into a pot plant. Never tried it, but, you know, it's an option. But look, I think we are all sending out a message, though, in who we are. And if you maintain some principles that you think is important, it's actually a really good message. And if you can share that with others, and if you have the strength to share that with others, even in the face of peer pressure, maybe it's worth it. And there will be times when we won't be liked. And that is completely normal. You know, even the Buddha himself had enemies. Not because he's done anything wrong, because things just happen, right? His cousin tried to kill him several times out of jealousy. So you can't please everyone. And if we spend our entire life trying to please everyone and trying to bend our principles to meet everyone's needs, you'll have a very, very difficult life and a very difficult time. And alcohol is but one example. There will be other times when they will push you in other ways, morally, ethically, right? And that's when you really learn, hang on, I need to stand my ground. These principles are important to me.
Just a quick on that. I think, in my understanding, I'm sort of confused between those values and those principles that you sort of see yourself in, whereas in contrast with the ego and identity.
Okay.
If you identify yourself with those sort of values,
yeah,
then isn't that a form of
ego? Oh, yeah. That's a really good point, yeah. So if I start saying, I'm a good Buddhist because I don't drink and I don't do that and I don't get that, yeah, absolutely, you're right. There's a lot of suffering in that. So when I say that these are the principles that we hold, these are the principles that we find are useful to our life and our practice, and we keep them dear to us. But it's not, I am these things, I am a good person. So you're spot on. Because a good example is, people think, as a Buddhist, you don't get angry. And whenever a Buddhist gets angry, other people go, hang on, you're a Buddhist. That's one. And the other one is, even if there is no one outside that says, hang on, you're getting angry, some Buddhists themselves beat themselves up and they go, I'm a Buddhist. I've been sitting in meditation, like, you know, every single day for the last couple of months. Why am I still getting angry? So instead of seeing anger as it is, something that arises because of conditions, we actually start attaching to it and we bring that into our identification as well. So, yeah, you're right.
What is your identification?
You don't identify. That's what I'm saying. So you don't identify yourself as, I'm a good Buddhist, you know, I don't drink, you know, all of those things. But it's a choice that we make.
So would you say that from a Buddhist perspective, I'm not saying this to excuse myself because I'm a social drinker. I actually don't drink a lot, but there's a lot of Buddhists out there who think that social drinker or drinking in general is bad. But I don't really see them that way.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's... Because I think, like, you respect them for who they are, because as long as they don't conduct into heavy drinker, they don't do anything bad for the society, then I think it's just a way of accepting... Say for the Aussie culture, it's just a part of it. And and people have fun, people have, you know, a cup of beer during New Year, so it's sort of acceptable, isn't it? I mean, if you look at it from a... non-egoism perspective.
Mm. Correct. So I'm not condemning them as bad people, but it's not behaviour that is conducive to a good spiritual practice. So you're not condemning the people, but you know, look at the behaviour and how it affects people. And then when you're around those people, how do you feel? And how do they behave once they start drinking? And when people drink, they often break the other precepts as well, right? A lot of crimes are committed because of that. And even people say the worst things, the horrible things. They can't control their emotions. They become very angry, very aggressive. They lose sight of what they're supposed to do, okay? So there's a whole heap of problems that comes out because of alcohol. And alcohol does kill the brain cells, right? So you deteriorate in terms of your body and your health. So there's actually lots of negative consequences of drinking alcohol. But again, we're not condemning the people. But it's just saying, so we're not saying that if you start drinking, you're a bad person. So what I said initially was there is no being up there going, oh, you just drank alcohol or you just lied, that's bad for you. It's not about that. It's not about judgment or condemnation. But rather, look at the behaviour and see how that affects you and how does it affect the people around you. And then you make your choice. So your earlier question to me, and you said, is that okay? My answer, quite honestly, is, well, that's your choice. You made that choice. That's your personal choice. Okay?
Yes. Can I add on something? So, yeah, this precept, the fifth precept, no intoxicants. You always think about just alcohol. But actually, any drink, if you consume enough, it will damage you and you'll damage your mind. Yeah, it's not just about alcohol. So, the reason that the fifth precept exists is because these drinks, these substances will affect your mind. So it's not just about, okay, no alcohol. It's anything that will disturb your concentration, your practice of Dharma. I think that's what the fifth precept is actually about. So, yeah, the thing about drinking alcohol and all, it's it's like...
One-sided?
Huh? What, one-sided? No, we just like... What? What? No?
Oh, you're suggesting words.
Oh, yeah.
I think I know what you mean. You're saying that it's not limited to just alcohol. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
So the right phrase is it's actually no intoxicants, okay? So anything that would affect your mind, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not just alcohol, it's also drugs, okay? But I think the conversation was about social drinking, so that's probably why it just geared towards there. But you're right. So anything that affects the mind, that clouds the mind. And coming back to the intention of holding that precept is because of that, because we value clarity. And if you, and after, especially after retreat, and you can see the clarity of mind, it becomes something very precious to you that you wouldn't want to let go of, like in not in a detached way, but you wouldn't want to rid it in any way. You wouldn't want to destroy it in any way. So that peacefulness, that clarity is something of value that you want to treasure. And then you can see, even with just one cup of alcohol, you can see how it affects the mind. Absolutely.
How should one react if you so happen to do a wrong action and then someone notices that and starts to condemn you, but
sorry, what?
How should you, if you are the person conducting the wrong action,
right,
and then there's someone who so happens to see that and then starts to attack you?
Okay. So what usually happens in you when that happens? How do you react? So the usual ways that people react is they get their back up and they just get defensive. So that's one reaction, okay? Some people get to the point where they even lie about it, that it never happened, so they deny it. Some people try to point the finger back at the other person and go, who are you to judge, you know, look at you and blah, blah, blah. Do you think that these are skillful ways of reacting? Probably not. Right? So if someone has criticized us, often the criticisms that hurt the most are the ones with truth in it. Right? So if someone calls me fat, I'll be like, right? Whatever. But if someone criticizes me and it actually has an ounce of truth in it, that's where it hurts the most. So before you react, it's really important to not say anything and just reflect and respond. So there's a difference between reaction and respond. Reaction's often without thinking, I'm just going to react. And often it's negative because you're coming from a negative place, which is protecting the ego, getting defensive, aversion, etc. But if you can respond, that response is well thought out, and it could be you don't say anything. So one response is actually no response. You don't need to say anything. And then depending on your relationship with the other person, you can acknowledge it, and you can tell yourself, I won't do it again. Or you can tell the other person, okay, I won't do it again. Or whatever it is. So it depends on what the criticism is and what your relationship with the other person is.
Actually, my answer to your question before was, I would feel shameful though,
yeah,
rather than the difficult ones that you...
Well, shameful is actually a good thing, right? But it's not guilt. So don't get to that point where you're just sitting there wallowing in guilt, because that really it just immobilises people. But rather, if there is a sense of shame, that's actually a good thing. And the Buddha actually said that is a good thing, because it means you understand wrongdoing. And because you have shame, you won't do it again. Yeah.
So, referring to that question, should we criticise people if they do wrong things though?
Are you criticising? Or
maybe our intention is good to maybe to teach him or her to be a better.
Yeah, it depends on. They all depend. It's so broad, these questions. But anyway, look, it depends on your relationship with them. It depends on the circumstance, and it also depends on how you deliver it. That is quite important, actually. So, if you think about the other person, how they would receive your criticism. If you do it in front of people, that's always a no-go. If you do it immediately after they do it, you have to check your emotions, because if you're reacting out of anger or hostility, that never works well. But if you take time to think about it and you pull them aside in a good way and you could talk to them, that would work. You've heard of the sandwich approach? Have you heard of the sandwich approach? You give them something nice, okay? So you give them a compliment. It has to be genuine, right? And it has to be relevant. So if you want to criticise them for the work, you don't say, oh, you're good looking today, right? Because that would just convey a totally different message. But you start with something good. So you can talk about something good that they've done in the project. You say, however, I noticed that you did this and this and this, you know? And then you end with, but look, you've done good stuff in the past. I know you can do it better, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So that's the sandwich approach. And constructive criticism is always best. So if you can show them how to improve, that's often better received as well. Yeah. It's really hard telling people that they've done the wrong thing. It takes a lot of guts because you're dealing with someone's ego. All right? And it gets hard with that. But it is an important thing that people need to do. Okay. Other questions? You look like you want to... Okay. No questions?
Thank you, Tina, for giving us the talk, and thank you, everyone, for the...